And good morning and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and we're on the web at KUCI.org and on iTunes at College Radio. So tell all your friends that they don't have to be sitting at home listening on the radio or at their computer. If you have a smartphone, you can easily access KUCI.org, and then in the upper right-hand corner, I think it is, you can hit Listen Live or Listen Now or Listen. Anyway, it's Wednesday, July 24th, 2013. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I'm here with Nicole Nelson. Hey, Nicole.
Hi, Barbara.
There you are. And our guests this morning are Karen Joy Fowler and David Groves. First up is Karen Joy Fowler. She's the author of 6 novels and 3 short story collections, including the Jane Austen Book Club, which spent 13 weeks on the New York Times bestseller list and was a New York Times notable book. Her previous novel, Sister Noon, was a finalist for the 2001 Pen Faulkner Award for Fiction, and her short story collection, Black Glass, won the World Fantasy Award in 1999, and her collection, What I Didn't See, won the World Fantasy Award in 2011. And she was on a few years ago for the Jane Austen Book Club, and it's a pleasure to have her back. Hey, Karen.
Hello.
Hi, great to have you back on the show.
Thank you. Coincidentally, I'm speaking to you from just down the road. I'm doing teaching at a workshop on the campus of UC San Diego.
Oh, so very cool. Okay.
I'm sitting in an office at your sister college.
What's the workshop?
The workshop is called the Clarion Workshop. Mm-hmm. It's a very, very intense 6-week summer workshop. So the students live on campus for 6 weeks, but they get a new instructor every week, which is very cunning because they get more and more tired, but the instructors arrive fresh and ready to crack the whip.
That's great. Okay, good to know about it. In any case, this is about you, and we are all completely beside ourselves. I'd love to hear you talk about the book and how it came about.
There are only 2 novels of the 6 that I've written that I can, in fact, tell you the exact moment I got the idea for the book. Mostly my process is a slow kind of accumulation of pebbles until I think I have a big enough hill to write a novel. But in those 2 cases, it all happened in an instant. And in the case of We Are All Completely Beside Ourselves, I had gone with my daughter back to Bloomington, Indiana, which is where I grew up, but left when I was 11. My daughter had never been in Bloomington. She was a college-age adult at the time. And my dad used to work on the campus at IU. He was a psychologist, and he had a lab in which there were many rats in rat cages. I feel strongly that I must be one of the few people in the world that has such a nostalgic pull towards the smell of rat cages. So I was showing her my dad's lab, and I started talking about an experiment in the 1930s in which a professor at IU University did an experiment where he, for 19 months, raised his infant son alongside an infant chimpanzee and tried to make their upbringing as similar as possible. So I was just describing this very, very famous experiment to my daughter, and she looked at me and said, wow, what would it be like to have a father who thought that was an appropriate way to raise you? You should write about that kid. I do not have good ideas myself, but I know them when I hear them. I thought, yes, I will do that.
Now tell me again when this happened. Was it close to when you started writing it, or were you working on something else at the time?
Not at all. This was actually the storied millennial New Year when this happened. My daughter and her boyfriend took me back to Indiana so that we could celebrate the big New Year Hoosier style, and we went to a John Mellencamp concert, and we saw a Pacers game, and we saw my dad's lab, and it was all quite wonderful. But as you will no doubt have already done the math, many, many, many years ago. In the interim, I wrote 2 other novels. I wrote the Jane Austen Book Club since that, and I wrote Wits End since that. But I have known that I would write this novel, and I have been reading things about it and collecting things about it and doing the research and just sort of intermittently mulling it over since then. I think I actually started to write it in earnest about 4 years ago.
Hmm, interesting.
And you mentioned, Karen, that this is the second time that a book came to you this clearly beforehand. What was the other one?
The other one was the Jane Austen Book Club. I was in the lovely Book Passage bookstore up in Northern California. I had gone to hear my friend Carter Schultz do a reading. There was just a sign on the wall that said the Jane Austen Book Club, and because I was in a bookstore, there was a moment when I thought that was the title of a book, and just felt my heart sort of race, thinking, oh, what a fabulous idea for a novel. I wish I'd had it. And then realized that it was, in fact, a book club and not a book at all, and that the book remained to be written.
That's interesting. Well, speaking of that book, because I did love that book, too, and I recall that was a multiple point of view novel with the book club members, and this one is a singular point of view. And curious about that, about point of view and how you choose and how you chose for each.
The idea that I had for the Jane Austen Book Club came complete with the structure, which was, as you said, Jane Austen wrote six primary novels, the six ones that everyone has heard of. And so I would have the book take place over 6 months. I would have six people in the book club, and the book would last six episodes each about a different member of the book club. For We Are All Completely Beside Ourselves, a lot of what the book is about, in my head at least, is language and who speaks and who doesn't speak and who wants to speak and who doesn't want to speak and who gets listened to and who doesn't. And my protagonist is a woman in her 40s at the time she's recounting the book, but most of the book takes place in her early childhood or in her college years. And in her early childhood, she was someone who talked a great deal, incredible chatterbox. But she has gotten increasingly quiet over the years. And so the book really is, in many ways, her regaining of her voice. She has a story to tell. I knew that I wanted to control the way the story was told very, very carefully, and when the reader got certain bits of information, and I wanted a character who was allowed to sort of tell you what you ought to be feeling about some of that information. So the only way that I felt comfortable doing that was from a first-person point of view. And Rosemary, who is my protagonist, is absolutely telling a story. There are direct addresses to the reader in the book, and has constructed it very carefully and is controlling it very carefully.
It's interesting to hear you talk about language and voice and who gets to speak, because the character, if you will, that comes to mind is the ventriloquist dummy that plays a part in the story. And I was wondering if you have any comments to make about that element as a character.
To be perfectly honest, since we're talking about writing and process, I got the idea for the ventriloquist dummy came really just from the fact that there was a locked suitcase, and I wanted something in it that would be weird and surprising, and I just sort of thought what would be something unexpected that you could take out of a suitcase that was not your own, and thought of a ventriloquist dummy. I am one of, I think, a large group of people who finds dummies intensely creepy in that sort of uncanny valley way, where I also put clowns and some kinds of dolls that are just disturbing. So I feel anytime you throw a ventriloquist dummy into the mix, it's a disturbing image. Having just had the idea of wanting something interesting, then it did also seem to me that I could make quite good use of it on the issue of language and how the dummy is personified by the people around her, and you know, she is of course the most literal possible emblem of somebody putting words in something else's mouth.
Interesting. You are listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. We are with Karen Joy Fowler. Her book is We Are Completely Beside Ourselves, and I stumbled there because I'm looking at an LA Times, I think it was an LA Times review, or maybe it was an OC Register review of the book that I haven't looked at since it came out, and they have your name as Karen J. Fowler.
That happens a lot.
Like, no, it's Joy.
But it happens all the time. I've gotten quite used to it. I console myself that you would be surprised the number of times that I have gone into a bookstore for the Jane Austen Book Club to sign stock or something and be told that they do not have the book because they are, in fact, misspelling Austin as if as the city in Texas.
Oh,
so I always think to myself, well, if it happens to Austin, then I can surely live with it.
Well, this would be a great time to hear you read from We Are All Completely Beside Ourselves. Could you do that?
I would love to.
Okay.
I'll, with your permission, I'll read the prologue and I will continue on to the very first paragraph
okay.
of the first chapter.
Sure.
So this is the prologue to my book. Those who know me now will be surprised to learn that I was a great talker as a child. We have a home movie taken when I was 2 years old, the old-fashioned kind with no soundtrack, and by now the colors have bled out, a white sky, my red sneakers a ghostly pink, but you can still see how much I used to talk. I'm doing a bit of landscaping, picking up one stone at a time from our gravel driveway, carrying it to a large tin wash tub, dropping it in, and going back for the next. I'm working hard, but showily. I widen my eyes like a silent film star. I hold up a clear piece of quartz to be admired, put it in my mouth, stuff it into one cheek. My mother appears and removes it. She steps back then, out of the frame, but I'm speaking emphatically now. You can see this in my gestures. And she returns, drops the stone into the tub. The whole thing lasts about 5 minutes, and I never stop talking. A few years later, Mom read us that old fairy tale in which one sister, the older, speaks in toads and snakes, and the other, the younger, in flowers and jewels. And this is the image it conjured for me, this scene from this movie, where my mother puts her hand into my mouth and pulls out a diamond. I was tow-headed back then, prettier as a child than I've turned out, and dolled up for the camera. My flyaway bangs are pasted down with water and held on one side by a rhinestone barrette shaped like a bow. Whenever I turn my head, the barrette blinks in the sunlight. My little hand sweeps over my tub of rocks. All this I could be saying. All this will be yours someday. Or something else entirely. The point of the movie isn't the words themselves. What my parents valued was their extravagant abundance, their inexhaustible flow. Still, there were occasions on which I had to be stopped. When you think of two things to say, pick your favorite and only say that, my mother suggested once as a tip to polite social behavior, and the rule was later modified to 1 in 3. My father would come to my bedroom door each night to wish me happy dreams, and I would speak without taking a breath, trying desperately to keep him in my room with only my voice. I would see his hand on the doorknob, the door beginning to swing shut. I have something to say, I'd tell him, and the door would stop midway. Start in the middle, then, he'd answer, a shadow with the hall light behind him, and tired in the evenings the way grown-ups are. The light would reflect in my bedroom window like a star you could wish on. Skip the beginning. Start in the middle. So this is the first paragraph of chapter one.
Okay.
So the middle of my story comes in the winter of 1996. By then, we'd long since dwindled to the family that old home movie foreshadowed, me, my mother, and unseen but evident behind the camera, my father. In 1996, 10 years had passed since I'd last seen my brother, 17 since my sister disappeared. The middle of my story is all about their absence, though if I hadn't told you that, you might not have known. By 1996, whole days went by in which I hardly thought of either one.
That was great. And,
thank you.
This starting in the middle, that sets yourself up for some tricky maneuverings in terms of storytelling. So did you outline, or was it in terms of the timeline, how did you organize that?
It seemed to me psychologically appropriate, and also in some large scale definition of the word, politically appropriate, that Rosemary not get right to the story. So her father's advice sort of gives her an excuse to hold off on some things she doesn't wish to say yet, and you know, to save them for later. I realized much later, after the book was sold, that I had set up quite a challenge for the marketing department and for myself when I go out to talk about the book. If I wish to keep Rosemary's secrets from people who haven't read the book yet, or if I wish, in fact, to talk about the whole book. The question of outlining is, I'm frequently asked if I outline my books, and I do, but not in the way that people imagine, I think. I was always the person in school who, if you had to turn in the outline with the paper, I would write the paper, and then I would do the outline. And that's the way I do my novels as well. I write the novel, and then I do an outline, and I look at the outline for what it can show me about structural decisions and weaknesses that I've made. But otherwise, I am one of the writers who makes it up as I go along.
So in terms of outlining after the fact, which I am a believer in, do you keep, I mean, once you do that, are you doing it like a traditional outline, or are you doing a plot board, or are you doing something visual so you can see the threads of the story and color coding and all that, or how does that take form?
Well, you know, now I'm doing it on Scrivener, the word processing program that has been designed for novel writers. Before, I had to, it would be mostly, a traditional outline. A lot of what I would be paying attention to is how many pages I gave to certain things, to see, you know, if I was spending more time than I ought to on things that were less important and less time on things that were more important, and also to track the through lines to see if, you know, if I was hitting them, returning to them at reasonable intervals without too much time passing in between. So just, you know, very technical kinds of issues.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you a bit about research, because you have so much in here about, about the mind, about memory, but about what happens to animals in animal laboratories, which are all over the place in so many universities. And I particularly like that aspect of the book, because it's hardly talked about, hardly written about, unless you read long-form narrative nonfiction. So I'd love to hear about that in terms of how that became such a big part of the book and why.
Well, you know, as I told you when I was talking about how I got the idea for the book, my father was an animal behaviorist, at least in the early years of his career. He did work with rats. There were, when I would visit his lab as a child, there were rhesus monkeys in the cages that I would have to pass in order to get to my father and the rats, and and you had to really give them a wide berth. They were, they would grab you, they would try to bite you, they were clearly kind of crazy, and it was just very disturbing. But, you know, in that way, when you're a child, you don't really question it. So, you know, it was something I was always told, not to go near the monkeys and to go well around them, because they could reach further than I would think they could reach. And I heard all of that advice without really asking myself a lot of questions about those monkeys, but I think they did lodge in my head. As an adult, I lived in Davis, California, where much of the book takes place, for many, many years, and I was there when the Animal Liberation Front burned the lab that was being built for animal research. Plus, I was there when a kind of scandal involving a long-lasting experiment with beagles and radiation became public. So these were all things, you know, well covered in my local newspaper and talked about, as you said, probably more than they would have been talked about in other places. It is just, you know, our treatment of animals in general is a subject that I am very, very interested in and try to think a lot about, try to be careful in my own life with regard to that. It seemed to me, again, you know, just plausible, more than plausible, inevitable, that the characters in my book who have been through what they have been through would this issue would be very front and center in their minds. I did do a lot of research, much of it very pleasurable. Obviously, the stuff on animals in labs, not so pleasurable, but in the 4 years that I was actively writing the book and in the 13 years that I was reading about it, the leaps in our understanding of animal cognition have really been amazing, and it has been amazing to be paying attention to those things while they happened. I find it fascinating the way so many animals have turned out to be so much more intelligent than we had imagined. As in the case of the chimps, their intelligence can sort of be correlated with ours in some way, but a lot of the other species, the intelligence takes such alien forms that it's taken us a while to recognize it as intelligence.
Hmm. Yes, well, I really appreciated it, especially because it seems that Nicole and I were talking on the way in about this and how, you know, with novels, it seems, at least I was told years ago by a mystery writer, that you can't have animals get hurt in novels because people won't read them. But that, you know, you can kill, you know, adults and children, and that's okay, and have the mystery revolve around that. So
I have not gone to look at it myself, but I have heard that there's a website called Does the Dog Die, where you can go look up books and movies before you get invested in them to find out if you're going to be put through that or not.
That is interesting. Now, I'm going to have to go look for that because, yeah, we could do a whole show on that. But
absolutely.
We are headed toward the end of our time here. I wonder if we could close out with you maybe just saying a little bit about creating suspense in a literary novel, because you have a lot of suspense throughout your book, but it's not a mystery. It's not a suspense novel. I would consider it a literary novel.
Thank you. In this case, a lot of the suspense in the book flows from that early decision to start in the middle. It allows Rosemary to conceal certain things that, as I write the book, I try to make you want to know. So I hope that you want to know what happened to her brother, that you will want to know what happened to her sister, and eventually you begin to get some information about it, and when you get that information, I very much hope you will want to know more. So I think in particular, as you understand more and more about her sister Fern and about what happened to her sister Fern, if the book works the way that I hope it will, that's the thing that keeps you turning the pages, that you will be increasingly concerned about Fern's fate. And as I said, Rosemary is controlling the narrative very carefully. So sometimes I dislike a novel where things are withheld, but I hope that in my novel, Rosemary's not my reasons for withholding, but Rosemary's, entirely her decision. I hope that will seem justified. And again, I think it's a large part of creating that sort of suspense.
Yes, yeah, I do too, and I so appreciate your time here and wish you great good luck with We Are All Completely Beside Ourselves. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Karen.
Bye-bye.
That was Karen Joy Fowler. Her book is We Are All Completely Beside Ourselves, published by Putnam. Stay with us. We will be right back with more Writers on Writing. So don't go anywhere. Thank you.
No, I love you, darling. Hate to see you go. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama, aching tears. Be gone 24 hours, child. Seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one more bed in a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby. Let's talk it over one more time.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. We are also on the web at kuci.org and iTunes College Radio. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and I'm here with Nicole Nelson.
Hello there.
Hello there. It was a delightful first half of the show with Karen Joy Fowler, and this show, along with the others, will be podcast eventually. Maybe sooner than later. Who knows? It has a lot to do with a lot of things when these shows get podcast. You can find the archive at writersonwriting.blogspot.com. If you click on a show and it's not working, in past years, have had trouble with the link staying active, just email me, and I'll take a look at it. Penonfire.com is the active website where you can find info about upcoming shows, about Pen on Fire speaker series events, and so much more. And we're here now with David Groves. He's a former international magazine and newspaper journalist. He grew up in Orange County, California, right here, and earned his BA in English Literature from UCLA. In recent years, he's been devoting himself to his two passions, fiction and the performance of magic. David published his new novel, What Happens to Us, on July 4th. And instead of me talking about it, I'm going to let him talk about it once we bring him on. Hey, David.
Hi.
Hi. Great to have you on.
Nice to be here.
Let's talk about What Happens to Us. Talk about the genesis of this book.
Well, it started with an idea. In 1989, I was reading this article of Psychology Today, and I saw they were talking about a phenomenon called state-dependent learning. And there was this, they were talking about how when people are drunk, really drunk, they fall into a blackout where in the morning they wake up and they can't remember what happened. But that when they get drunk again, they can remember everything that happened during the blackout. And a light went on in my head, and I thought, what if there were a clue or something essential that was buried in that blackout memory? And the person was a recovering alcoholic, and she had to get drunk again in order to save her life. And that was the original idea, and I carried that idea around in my head for 18 years, until finally in 2007 I combined it with a bunch of other ideas. And I started writing this book, which is basically the idea of a woman being chased by somebody. She doesn't know who it is. She realizes that she must have met him during a drunken blackout. And turns out that he works in government surveillance. And then she realizes that in order to solve her problem, she's going to have to figure out who exactly he is and to put a stop to it. And in order to do that, she's going to have to get drunk again. And that's when all hell breaks loose.
That's really interesting, actually, about the blackouts, because, you know, in my early days, I've had some of those, and so all I have to do is get drunk again to see what happened.
That's right.
I don't know the last time I've been drunk, but
sure.
That is really interesting. I had no idea.
It's a fascinating phenomenon.
Hmm. So you have said, you've described the book as a thriller with literary aspirations. Talk about that. Talk about, categorizing, for one thing, that it seems that we all need to categorize our fiction these days so that they know where to put it. But talk about that, like, in terms of it being more a thriller with literary aspirations. What does that mean exactly?
Well, you know, unfortunately, I think there are a lot of thrillers that are where the writing is just not very good. And where it's all about the hardware and the guns and the action and who's coming to kill you. And I don't write that way. You know, I write about characters, and I write about the inner life. And so, I mean, I was fascinated by this format of the thriller, in which somebody is being chased, because in that format, you have interest all the time, because the person is in danger, even when they're in their quietest moments, when they seem the safest. The reader always knows that the hammer could come down at any time. And so, being fascinated with that, I decided to write a book like that. But I realized that I couldn't write a book at all unless it had something about the human heart and the human struggle in it. And so there are large numbers of chapters where it's mainly just character development and people's stories.
Hmm. And so it seems that, to me, with literary fiction, challenges I've experienced as well as challenges I see my students going through and books I pick up that are literary novels, they lack suspense, or it's easy to lack suspense, I should say, because they don't all lack suspense, but it seems that creating suspense in literary fiction is especially hard, because you're not relying on, you know, those immediately suspenseful, typical suspenseful scenes happening, but there has to be something else happening on the pages to make you keep turning the pages.
Sure. I think there's a very mysterious kind of meta-plot that underlies all story. And that's, you know, what does the reader expect? And where do they think that a story is going to go? And I think it behooves every writer to know what those expectations are. It's not plot. I mean, plot is what happens next. It's what does the reader expect? And I think you have to know how to trigger those expectations. There are some writers who really know it. Who's that? I can't remember the name of one I recently read. Kate Braverman,
mm-hmm.
who seems to know about that. But when you don't know about expectations, I was talking to Beverly Gray, who's an author of biographies, and she worked in the Roger Corman movie studio back in the 60s and 70s, I think. And she, you know, the people in the Roger Corman studio, what did they make? Little Shop of Horrors and all those B-movies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they knew about expectations to a T.
Mm-hmm.
But when a really good storyteller knows about it, then you have really something to read.
Mm. Interesting. Well, you know what? This would be a great time to hear you read from your book. Would you please?
Sure.
Okay. So David Groves is about to read from What Happens to Us, just published July 4th.
Okay. Just a little to set it up.
Mm-hmm.
During the first third of the novel, my main character, Kat, is being chased. And at a certain point, she breaks free and she picks up a partner who's a street performer. And they go to upstate New York, and they start living beneath, in the tunnels underneath the university. And he brings in cash in the cash underground by performing on the street in New York City. And she starts thinking about that. All the while, Kat wondered if Dante's jungle was one in which she could possibly survive. There was only one form of combat that gave her a fighting chance. From the moment she could speak, Kat had sung all the time, constantly, never stopped. Her first spoken words had been fa-la-la. Occasionally, her mother would try to kill it. "Will you stop it, girl? You're driving me batty." Or she would just go into the backyard and pull a switch off the tree and give her daughter a whipping. "That'll teach you." In time, Kat learned to sing only outside the house. It didn't matter that people looked at her strangely at school. By six, however, the forces of discouragement finally reached a critical mass. One unpleasant boy called her "Shut Up Mouth." Quote, "Because you make me want to tell you to shut up your mouth." The term tard was thrown around. So finally, she just shut up. At 13, a neighbor convinced her mother that her child should start going to the local Baptist church. Kat joined the choir, where Miriam, the red-haired choir director, knew music, but not how to talk to people. The strict doctrine of this particular faction prohibited both mechanical instruments and solos. Kat often longed for a great voice, but then scolded herself for coveting personal glory. Besides, it was Rose, the girl who stood next to her, who had an operatic voice and a three-octave range. By the time Kat turned 17, strange things began happening in the church. Miriam disappeared without a word. Kat was now getting drunk with Lainey every weekend on fake IDs. On Sunday mornings, desperately clinging to some vestigial idea of goodness, Kat dragged herself to church despite epic hangovers. One day, Kat ran into Miriam at a hardware store. A strange relaxation now filled her face and voice. "I met a man," Miriam said. "Oh." "He's teaching me about the world. It's not as bad as they say, the world. It's strange. The further I get from the church, the happier I become." That confused Kat, because on the one hand, misbehaving pleased her as well. But at the same time, her hangovers seemed like ancient judgment and pulled her back. "They excommunicated me, you know," Miriam said with a sly grin. "You're kidding." "They did it in secret. Five miserable honchos in a church of 70 miserable wannabes trying to ruin the life of someone who's finally thrown away her antidepressants." "That's sad." Miriam sighed, then smiled. "You've graduated then?" "Next month." "Will you be continuing your music?" "Oh, no, I'm no Rose." "Rose?" "Yes, I don't have her technique. She has all the talent." A mysterious smile appeared on Miriam's lips. "You're mistaken," Miriam said. "What do you mean?" Miriam had always withheld compliments because, she thought, Kat possessed only an average voice. The dream that Kat might have anything better had been dashed a couple years earlier. "Rose has all the skills and God-given gifts, that's true," Miriam said, "but there's something more important than all that." Miriam searched for the words as if they were scattered on the waters like lilies, and she was mute until she saw the right one. "You feel the music," Miriam said in a conspiratorial near whisper. "The feeling makes all the difference." The look on Miriam's face was something Kat had never forgotten. Contrary to church doctrine, as it turned out, Kat had an actual self, and apparently it was an extraordinary and beautiful one as well. She floated on a cloud for the longest time. She took that comment and protected it in a glass case in her heart, even through her years as a drunk, and then into her past year of sobriety. It was something she reached for when she was low. When a man didn't call her back after her first date, or she failed to land the job she wanted, or someone at work ran a head game on her, she would sit in front of the glass case and fill herself up with Miriam's long ago comment. Now, with street performing, Cat had a chance again. Maybe now, the river of Fa-la-la would begin flowing through her again. Maybe she could finally reclaim herself.
Thank you so much. That was David Groves reading from What Happens to Us. We have so much to talk about. We should have booked an hour, but anyway, we've known each other a long time. We met through the American Society of Journalists and Authors, and for years we've been talking about agents and publishing and just the challenges with both. And you recently direct published this book or self-published the book, and I'd love to hear why and how you came to that decision.
Sure. Well, I...
Long story.
Right. Well, as I said, I started writing this book in 2007 after we learned about the warrantless surveillance program in this country, and I decided to set it, you know, in warrantless surveillance, where a man is working in warrantless surveillance, and for most of the time that I was writing it, there was just no news on the subject. No one was talking about it. I had Google searches on it. There was no news on it, Google alerts on it. And I finished writing the book in May after 6 years. And 2 weeks later, Edward Snowden hit the news. And I thought, this is the moment, and I just can't wait. And so I...
Say a few words about Snowden.
Edward Snowden is the... NSA employee who went to the Guardian newspaper and leaked the fact that the United States government is doing surveillance on everyone, including ordinary Americans, not just potential terrorists, but ordinary Americans. And so there's been a big uproar about this. And that's really what I've been writing about, is somebody who's in this kind of structure who's out of control. And I just thought, this is just too good to wait, and I just wanted to take advantage of it. And that's why I did an end run around the agents.
Hmm. So what sort of process did you go through? I mean, you know, typically you get an agent, the agent and the author, you know, go back and forth a few times, you know, on drafts, and then hopefully the agent sells the book, and then the editor and the author go through, you know, drafts or copy editing or line editing, proofreading, vetting, all that stuff.
Sure.
So what did you do? How did you then proceed from, you had the idea, you want to get the book out there and you want to do it fast, and knowing that if you sell it to a publisher, it's probably going to be at least a year.
Right.
And so what happened? What happened next?
Well, you know, I went through all the back and forth with my readers. You know, I have a community of readers around me, people who are really interested in my writing, and I'm interested in theirs, and I trust their judgment. In fact, I even have somebody close to me who is my writing professor at UCLA when I was a student back in my 20s. And so he's my friend now. He's no longer a professor, but he's my friend. And we look at each other's writing. And, I went through all that. And really, when I finished, I was really finished. So I suppose an editor could have made it better. An editor could have made it worse, too. So I felt that it was finished. And, you know, I've been a writer for many years, so I know that it was finished. In terms of publishing it, you know, I had to format it, and I knew that there might be some technology challenges, but I just stepped up to the plate, and there are instructions on the internet on how to format your manuscript, and it took me 3 hours. It wasn't much, and I just went through the instructions, and you know, the cover was a challenge. But last year I learned Photoshop. I bought Photoshop, and I learned it. I spent 3 months just crashing into it and learning it, and man, it is such a great thing to have if you. You know, if you buy Photoshop, it's a great thing to have, even for your personal use. But I mean, to make a cover. And one of the things I did was I took photographs of my main characters in her 20s, and I saw these eyes on the cover of my book, these eyes that were fearful, just a strip of eyes. And so I went around to 20-year-olds that I knew, and I said, could you look scared for me, and I can take your picture? I don't know. There were some restraining orders. But finally, I got one of our relatives, and she got the picture, and I ran it through Photoshop, and I came out with a cover that was really good. And I put it all together as a package, and it's really, I mean, if you have... Formatting something in nonfiction format is, with all the, you know, if it has a lot of pictures, is really kind of an ordeal. But if you just have text, pretty much just text, it's not nearly as bad. So that's what I went through.
Hmm. You're listening to Writers on Writing. Nicole and I are with David Groves. His new novel is What Happens to Us. So, you know, one reason I think writers like to go with publishers is because publishers will promote our books, and publishers don't do a whole lot for most authors these days. I think for major authors they get a lot of attention, but book tours are becoming a thing of the past, and now virtual book tours on Goodreads and other online sites are happening more and more. So what about promotion? I mean, do you put a certain amount of time every week to promotion, or have you found, I don't know, Facebook, Twitter, Pinterest, I don't know, online sites, social media sites useful to you in promoting, or how are you thinking about promotion, and what are you doing to make sure it happens? Because, you know, we're writers, so we want to write. We don't want to promote so much.
Right. Well, you know, it's not a certain number of hours per week. It's a certain number of hours per day. And I love this book so much that that sometimes I put down my head and I promote it on social media, and I look up and it's 4 hours later.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's really such a passion of mine that it's just no difficulty to do that. And I'm using social media. I'm using Amanda Hocking as my new idol.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the 27-year-old woman who wrote the vampire romance books that and self-published them in digital format and made a couple million dollars in 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
And so I study what she did, and there are some models out there. I think J.A. Conrath.
Mm-hmm.
Heard of him.
Sure.
And I'm trying to use social media without being a pest, but trying to promote it on WordPress and, you know, blogging, using YouTube as social media rather than just to watch things.
Mm-hmm. Because you have, on YouTube, you have a bunch of, I know I've seen your magic, some of your magic on YouTube.
Yeah, that's an advantage that I have is that I do something that people want to watch.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've come up with... I put videos on there where I show videos of the three-card Monty, which is kind of a magic trick and a con game, and it's fascinating to watch. But it's related to my book because it's about deception. My book is about deception, and I've done a little video on that. It's like 1 minute or 2 minutes, and I put out videos to, you know, I have a camera that takes video, and sometimes I just ask my girlfriend to point the camera at me, and I blab about it for a minute.
Mm-hmm.
And then we just post it.
So on Facebook, you are your name, right? David Groves?
Yes.
Are you on Twitter?
I'm trying to figure out Twitter. I am on Twitter, but I, for some reason, it's confusing to me.
Okay. And do you have a website?
You know, not for this particular book. It's come at the last minute, so I published this on July 4th, but... I do have a website at david-groves.com.
So Facebook would be the best place for people to follow you.
Right.
Okay. So back to then the writing, and, you know, I guess I'm curious about your process, because you've been at work at this for a long time and you do other things too. Talk a little bit about keeping it going. You know, I think sometimes when when books happen over the long term, meaning not just, you know, I wrote it, I started a year ago, and now it's done and off. How do you keep projects alive, and how do you, I don't know, keep them moving and follow the thread and pick it up again and know where you are?
Yeah, you know, a novel is really so sprawling. I mean, my book is 85,000 words. And, you know, it's kind of like a country. It's like, you know, this is the Midwest, and this is Louisiana, and this is, you know, there's so many different parts of a book. And especially in a book like mine, where the parts are so different. I mean, there are some chapters that are very quiet. There's one chapter that's completely in the underground, where they're able to sneak into the college library from midnight until 4 o'clock in the morning and use the books. And that's just such a quiet, restful kind of section of my book. It's in terms of keeping it going, I think you have to stay interested in it, and you have to look at those characters and kind of fall in love with them, and you have to choose characters that you can fall in love with, because there are characters that you really don't want to spend 6 years with, but I chose the most interesting characters that I could, and I tried to put some characters in who just didn't end up being in because they weren't interesting enough to me. And I think a novel shouldn't just be a story. It should be a collection of greatest hits. And if something, you know, when you buy a CD and maybe you end up having two or three songs that you like and the rest are just kind of boring.
Mm-hmm.
But when you buy a greatest hits, every song is great. Well, I want my novel to be like that. And if there's something that doesn't earn its weight, I want to cut it out. And so that keeps you interested. And plus, another thing is that I do have some insomnia. And when I wake up in the middle of the night, you know, my acupuncturist says that I shouldn't do this, but I go to the computer.
Mm.
And I work on the book, and it's very relaxing. It's very, I try to make something out of it. So, late at night.
Right at night. Well, I have just enjoyed having you on. I'm so glad we could do this at the last minute.
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
I guess we're at the end of our time, and we have to go. That was David Groves. His book is What Happens to Us, and it's available online. And I think you can also read excerpts online. And do follow him on Facebook. David Groves, I'm sure if you have any questions about his book or self-publishing or anything having to do with publishing, you could message him. Except, of course, now there's the other folder that messages go into that if someone's not your friend, you don't know that they've sent you a message unless you look in the other folder. So annoying. But anyway, that's a whole other topic that we don't have time for. Nicole, thank you for being here.
Oh, Barbara, thank you.
And all of you out there, thank you for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine.